This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 26th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 98th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're bouncing uphill and down dale, crossing the continents. We're an international cultural pinball that, in your service, dear listeners, are pinging to these points. Best-selling novelist John Niven will be telling us about his hilarious and rather touching new book, Straight White Male, that deals with words, deeds and drink.
And it was also with Kennedy. I wanted to create that kind of thing. We don't see it so much in literature now, but novelists used to be a bit more like rock stars.
We'll visit the famous Edinburgh Fringe Festival to take a walk on the wild side in theatre, performance, cabaret and other wonderful oddities.
The story itself is quite dark, the dubstep makes it quite heavy, and so we just wanted little moments of sort of frivolity.
And we'll learn about the hidden depths of teletext. Of course, Europe still embraces it as an art form. We check out people taking it very seriously in Berlin.
If you do an artwork for teletext, there's only six colours. You know, you have like yellow, red, pink, turquoise, blue and green, and then you have black and white. So it's very limited.
Plus, we'll hear what an orchestra played by the wind sounds like in Helsinki. We'll swoon to the sounds of Emily Barker in this week's Midori House session, and we'll submerge ourselves at an underwater music festival in Miami. That's all happening in the next 53 minutes, right here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And it's a great pleasure to introduce you to this week's musical guest. Emily Barker is one of those seemingly effortless singer-songwriters with a country twist, a rocky temperament, and luckily for us, a great new record called Dear River to play from. From it, this is the title track, Dear River.
Dear River, won't you take me out of here? Tell your friend the sea that I'll be waiting at the pier. Then throw me down to those rolling waves. They're gonna take me the rest of the way. Show me bright city lights and streets I've never seen. Make a home for me on the path in between. Then move me on like an autumn bird. For I want to fly all around the world. Pull me in so we're close enough to kiss. Read the stars to me. For the sky, it is a myth. Then hand me over to that restless wind. We're gonna ride to a land we've never been. But in every floodlit archway and in every fading tide goes the memory of a self I've left behind. So please take me from these bright lights. I've loved them more than they have me. Take me back to where out of here. day from the sea, that I'll be waiting at the pier, then throw me down to those rolling waves. They're gonna take me the rest of the way.
That was Emily Barker with Dear River, and as ever, there's more to come later on in the show. Now I want to talk about one of my favourite novelists, the author of Unimaginable, the youngest writer to be nominated for the Booker Prize, a celebrated screenwriter and a louche living professional Irishman. He's called Kennedy Marr, he's entirely fictional, and he's the new creation of actual novelist and screenwriter John Niven, whose new novel, Straight White Male, follows the amusing life of the writer, drinker, womaniser and quota of Yeats.
A few crumbs of tarto citron on the plate and a $23 glass of Sauterne in his hand, the liquid heavy as cough syrup, the author feeling expansive now in the 4 o'clock sunlight slanting across the restaurant, the place having taken on the underwater tint of afternoon drinking. It was a submarine, a diving bell. Kennedy sat alone at the table. Braden was outside taking a call. His phone had started going crazy towards the end of the meal, as had Kennedy's, which remained staunchly ignored in the inside pocket of his suit. But then a two-hour lunch was SOP for the author. For a Hollywood manager, it constituted an unauthorised vacation. Kennedy raised his glass to nobody and murmured, "To absent friends, fuck them." He drained it, called for brandy. "Sure, and it's far from how you were raised," as his mother would have said.
A little taster there of the character Kennedy Marr from John Niven's new book, Straight White Male. And I wondered, how very different is art from life? Mr. Marr? Mr. Niven?
It's the same answer with every book. There has to be enough of you in it to make it work, but he's not quite me by any stretch. Yeah. As neither was Stephen Stillfox, which a lot of people seem to imagine.
This was the record label manager from Kill Your Friends.
A lot of people will meet you and shake your hand quite gingerly, thinking that you're that guy, you know. But look, Kennedy, obviously, because he's a writer, there's a bit more of me than him, maybe, in that sense.
Writing a book about a writer who's writing as well, you know, and coming to terms with what he's writing. And you quote Graham Greene's sliver of ice in the heart, which is what every novelist needs in order to be able to notice the awful things going on around them, all the wonderful things, but to be able to note it down. How tough is writing a book about a writer?
You have to be careful, because I think it's very easy to, on one level, who cares? Great, you're a writer writing a book about being a writer. It's sort of self-referential, and it can be in a sort of...
Because you know people are going to read it and go, but has he got this bit right and that bit right?
Well, then again, making them a writer, it does allow them access to sort of, you know, the job is noticing things and delving into it and commenting on it. So, you know, if your character, for instance, to use the book I just mentioned, Kill Your Friends, when you get a character like Stillfox, there's just a lot of stuff he would never notice. Like, they're on a flight, I think, at one point in that book, and in an early draft, I had him sort of noticing the sunset as you flew into Cannes, and I had to take it out because I thought he wouldn't be so poetic. You know, he'd be nose deep and loaded or nuts or something, you know, whatever it was at the time. So, you know, when your protagonist is a writer, it does give you license to sort of go places that are, you know.
Yeah. There's a separation, because we learn, I don't want to spoil the ending for everybody, but there's a very nice neat ending to it, but there's a bit of a lack of separation technically between the narrator and Kennedy as well, because there is a narrator that isn't Kennedy, right?
The book's written in the third, what you'd call the sort of the localized third person, as opposed to Kill Your Friends was the first person, and it, again, it allows you to comment on the character with a little distance. And what that allowed you to do in the second, there's a slight tonal shift in the book, because the first half, which is all in Los Angeles, is kind of fun and games, and you know, making a fortune, spending a fortune, getting raped, getting laid, and then the book in the second half sort of modulates into slightly more somber tone, you know, as you know. My friend Indy Knight, the columnist, actually brought this up on He and Why recently. She was asked, why was it that men seem to own the midlife crisis novel as a concept more than women did? And she said, well, I think it's because middle age, most of them have probably behaved more badly.
Right.
And I thought this was very true, that by the time you reach a certain age, you have, you know, you've made certain choices that are irrevocable and you've done certain things. And, you know, maybe some of them weren't the best choices, but you've got to find some, as Kennedy says in the book, you need to find some way to coexist with them. You know?
And this idea of dead white males, which is sort of the canon of Western literature, which we all learn at school, at university. Kennedy Marr's a fan of them. Maybe you are, I don't know. But a lot of them pop up in quotes. Martin Amis and his father Kingsley, Joyce, Yeats, and even Morrissey towards the end.
Yeah.
How can you read books when you're writing, or do you have to sort of separate those two so you don't get too inured with the fiction you're reading?
I can't really read new fiction when I'm writing a book, because you're just scared of subliminally picking up in somebody's manner, you know, if the book's any good. At any rate, I can reread. I mean, some of my favourite novels I've read 7, 8, 12, 10 times, you know. So I'll reread things that I know and love, because let's face it, that's probably already in your stylistic makeup somewhere. But no, I tend to avoid new fiction. But the dead white males thing, there's a certain kind of person who loves bashing the literary canon, and, you know.
But I've got a specific question for you on that. When Kennedy Marr moves to England and he's given this literary prize and he's at Deeping University,
correct.
It did remind me of a sort of small time but memorable literary spat between Terry Eagleton and Martin Amis.
Yeah, well, then you're kind of right to notice that.
Right.
That's the kind of thing.
The kind of thing that
it was meant to represent, you know? Mm. And while I get the argument that, you know, you can make that sort of Marxist critic argument about what texts get excluded from the mainstream and who does the choosing and whatnot, and then the day, books tend to remain in print for a long time because they find an audience and people like reading them and they pass it on. And that's, you know, the frustrating thing, certainly as a novelist, is you'll never really get to know your worth, because it won't be decided till many decades after you're dead if you're still in print.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think, and that's, Kennedy Marr has a great sense of his posterity, right? Of his importance, or wanting to sort of go down in history. Do you think he does, or do you think the people around him maybe think that that's the case?
I wouldn't say Kennedy was that specifically egotistical like that. I think he, you know, if you do the work and you think it has some value, you would like to flatter yourself that it'll remain in print. And when I read novelists who I love, I was just talking about Elmer Leonard yesterday in an interview, because he died. Yeah. You know, he wrote 40 books. And if you read some of his novels from the 70s, they're as fresh as some, you know, somebody in the 30s or 20, late 20s writing them now. And it's just very sobering to remind yourself that Elmer Leonard was born in 1925 and not 1965.
And that directness of his language.
Mm.
Hugely
influential writer, you know. And a bit like Kennedy in the book, you know, he has a screw up in lots of ways, but he has got a very strong work ethic. You know, he gets the work done one way or another.
There's some brief moments of exposition where he buries his head in his papers or in his screenplays and all the rest of it in order to get sort of stuff done.
Mm.
But we don't know a huge amount about the actual working life of the novelist Kennedy Marr. Only his private life wrought public, I guess, which is the good thing, right?
Well, part of that was it's much, you know, yeah, as you say, what goes on at the desk isn't that fascinating. It's a guy sitting at a desk.
The guy banging his head against the wall for 10 hours a day.
That's not that entertaining. But what they got up to outside of that can be fun. And it was also with Kennedy, I wanted to create that kind of thing. We don't see it so much in literature now, but novelists used to be a bit more like rock stars. If you think back to someone like Norman Mailer, just constantly in the gossip columns and out in the lash, and, you know, going on TV in your boxer shorts to offer to beat up Truman Capote, or Gore Vidal, I think it was, rather.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, I wanted Kennedy to be a bit more of that old school stripe, because I thought it'd be fun.
And in terms of the place, the book's place sort of in the cultural landscape, where are you taking it? You were saying that you were talking to India Knight at Hay on Wye, presumably obviously about this book, to promote the book. What's the sort of life of the novel? I know you go online and talk about it a lot and it gets talked about, which is a great thing. Is that sort of stuff useful? Is that how modern novelists, is that how you operate?
Yeah, hugely so. It's a real... I also write screenplays, and if you watch a movie that you've written in the theatre with an audience, it's an incredible thing to, if they all react in exactly the right way you intended on the page at the same moment. Now, previously in history as a novelist, there was just no way, you know, you get the odd fan letter, of course, but you would never get a sort of in real time almost experience of what people were reacting to the book like. You know, it's almost, you know, instantaneous.
You see it,
you know, in a wave, and as people get the book this week, the book only came out a few days ago, and people reacting to it there and then. And it's fairly amazing. Obviously, it's a very recent thing that you get that.
That was the delightful John Niven, and his new book, Straight White Male, is out now, published by William Heinemann. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, where we travel now from London up the East Coast mainline to the city of Edinburgh. The town's been alive all month, with hundreds of thousands of people descending on the Scottish capital for the biggest arts festival in the world. As ever, it's a frantic battle between venues, performers and shows for audiences and positive reviews, and for punters, a race against the clock to get a glimpse of even a fraction of what the festival has to offer. Reporter Hazel Pfeiffer popped up there for a few days to soak up some of the energy, and between improv comedy, original theatre and experimental music, she encountered clowns, cavemen, giant snails, beard playing, ukuleles and more than a few kilts.
The Royal Mile sweeps majestically through the heart of Edinburgh's old town. The cobbled streets are filled with people handing out flyers, drama students in fancy dress heckling passers-by,
hilariously funny comedy,
and mini stages with a cappella groups bursting into song. The Edinburgh festivals are in full swing. International street performers from all over the world are competing for audiences and spare change, much to the amusement of the crowd.
Do you want to see me juggle three solid steel machetes on a 10-foot ladder?
Yeah!
Have you enjoyed the show so far?
Yeah!
Are you about to give me lots of money?
Yeah!
With juggling of a different kind, musician Adam Page doesn't play just one instrument, or even two or three. I counted 10. The saxophone, flute, harmony flute, keyboard, didgeridoo, guitar, and even his beard all feature as Adam bounces around the stage beatboxing and using loop pedals to meld the sounds into a one-man symphony.
So it takes a lot of thinking, but once I've put a loop down, I forget about that. You know, it's on to the next one. So it might seem like, wow, there's just so many things going on through your head, but it's really only one thing at a time.
While music, comedy and cabaret are everywhere, theatre is the real heart and soul of the festival. Edinburgh's Gothic architecture and dramatic fuse are an apt backdrop for some high-calibre thespian action, including Our Fathers, a deceptively simple play with subtle complexities by Birmingham group Babacus. The three main characters play themselves and intertwine their own personal relationships with their fathers into one poignant narrative, using multimedia, contemporary dance, and audience interaction to bring the story alive. Sophie Pachou is single and looking for a date. Mike Tweddle is faced with the unexpected prospect of being a father.
In the email, she told me about Gemma, a beautiful art curator in her late 30s who already has one child by an ex-husband but wants to have a second child, and no relationship has been forthcoming.
And Bert Hohmann is unreconciled with his religious father. I asked him how much personal material was in the play.
It's all personal material, but with little dramatic twists.
This process kind of gave me a reason, I guess. The diaries that my dad sort of left behind were just in a box, and I was always a bit nervous about looking at them, but once we realised we wanted to make a show about fatherhood, it was a way to explore them and to try and connect memories of him with ideas we thought were interesting about masculinity, about parenthood, about generational difference and conflict.
On the other side of town is Maysa Sabahi, the first Saudi to perform in the Edinburgh festivals. In her student days, she became the first Saudi Arabian stand-up comedian and is now a playwright and champion of the dramatic arts in her country. Her play, Head Over Heels in Saudi Arabia, takes an upbeat look at marriage in the Gulf state, where men can have up to four wives.
Well, you know what? I met this really lovely woman at work, and I think she's going to be wife number two. Really? How lovely. Congratulations. Shall I get dinner ready for you?
It was just,
you know, close to my heart and also close to an experience that I had gone through, because I lived in Saudi Arabia for many years as a divorced woman and a married woman and a mother. And so all these things were things that were touching me. I don't think a lot of people know what it is for women in Saudi Arabia to experience, or in the Arab world in general.
And how has the play been received in Saudi Arabia?
I mean, I think the people in Saudi Arabia like that and are thirsty for that. And I think there's a whole kind of genre of stand-up comedians coming up, evolving in Saudi Arabia because of that. That light entertainment is something I think they welcome.
Another performance that's standing out this year is Pants on Fire's dark version of the Disney classic Pinocchio. It's the wooden puppet story like you've never seen it. A kitsch 1950s tale with giant crickets, magical snails, and a dubstep soundtrack.
You're nothing like any boy I ever seen. You've got nothing in that head of yours but wood.
Jess Mabel-Jones is the show's artistic director.
We like to take classic stories and we like to turn them on their heads a bit.
Explain to me a bit about the commercials, because peppered in the story you've got these uber kitsch songs for commercials for everything from shampoo to bug spray.
That was to play with the consumerism of the 1950s. It's the first time where people started to have the money to be able to buy things, and things were made to break. It's also an idea to make the whole piece a little bit lighter, to give a little bit of light relief. The story itself is quite dark, the dubstep makes it quite heavy, and so we just wanted little moments of sort of frivolity and silliness for the sake of it.
As arts festivals go, Edinburgh is still the cultural World Cup. So if you're headed to the city in August, the best option is to get a front row seat and enjoy the action. For Monocle, in Edinburgh, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
The show's Hazel Saul. We're part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which has just wrapped up, but it's festival fever in the city right now, and the international festival runs until the 1st of September, so it's not too late to book a flight or a train to Scotland for a cultural excursion. Edinburghfestivals.co.uk has all the details. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're going back to Pixels next.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we're going retro now to explore a medium that screams of analogue early computers and shell suits. Not sure what I mean? It's teletext, of course, and even if the BBC got rid of CFAX a good while ago, here in the UK it's still a popular interactive text feature on TV stations elsewhere in Europe. But who knew its nostalgic look could also lend itself to visual art? Well, the second edition of the International Teletext Art Festival, or ITAF, is currently taking place, and the stations ARD in Germany, ORF in Austria, and Swisstex in Switzerland are all displaying works by 16 artists using the pixely format. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley met organiser Frauke Langut at the ARD Berlin studios, where the designs can also be seen, to find out about a medium that lets viewers truly tune in and tune out.
The very special thing about teletext art is you can make it, but you have to have a station to broadcast it. And usually artists don't own broadcast stations, so they were really happy that we said, yeah, come to ARD Teletext and we will give you some pages, as we call it, and you can present your art there.
This seems to also include some broadcasters in other countries. Is it bigger this year than it was last year?
Yes, last year we were all by ourselves, but this year we are doing it together with Switzerland and Austria. So it's getting bigger and bigger. And last year it was already, we had artists from all over the world. We had one guy from California, from England, from Sweden, from France. And I like this a lot because usually we are a German station and we don't have many influence from other countries. So we had all these artwork and it was just great.
Here in the station in Berlin, I see screens in the entryway that have the different artworks kind of rotating among them. But can people who are watching television switch to teletext and see this exhibition as well?
Yes, I mean, this is like a double. We are doing it here and at the building of our broadcast station. People can walk in and watch it. But the big thing or the real thing is to watch it at home. And I really like this. You know, teletext is very popular in Germany. We have like 5 million viewers a day for our program. And altogether in Germany, maybe 15 million viewers a day, which is quite a lot for all stations. So everybody at home, and in Germany, all television sets have teletext. You know, they take their remote control, they push the button, and then they have go to the first program, they have to choose the page 850, and they can visit the exhibition. And I like the idea that people might stay at home, you know, even they might be laying in their bed or wearing nothing or whatever, and they can watch it in the night, you know, and you can watch it as long as you like. And it turns out that a lot of the artwork is really, for me, it's like meditation, you know, you can watch it really for a long time. We have, for example, one picture is just a yellow square. You know, this sounds very simple, but in the night it's bright and it's brilliant, you know, it's yellow light. You can sit there and think about this. Or we have a cat, you know, these lucky cats from the Chinese stores, and just moving its arm up and down, you can watch it for hours. You know, if you're nervous, we get really lucky seeing this. And so the artwork, first I thought it's just, you look at it fast, you know, oh, it's easy to understand. But a lot of the artworks are really, they have a message you have to find out. So take your time. And if you can't approach German or Swiss or Austrian television, you can look at it at the internet. But there it's not as nice really as on a TV set.
How did the artists get curated into this festival? Was it an open call? And how many artists are exhibiting?
It was not really open. The curator is Juha van Ingen. He's from Finland, and he asked people to participate. Some of them were really active before on the teletext art, but others have never done teletext before. And, you know, you have to know, if you do an artwork for teletext, there's only 6 colors. You know, you have like yellow, red, pink, turquoise, blue, and green, and then you have black and white. So it's very limited. And you have a certain number of lines. You know, you have 23 lines with 40 characters you can use. I mean, when we write text, it's the same. So very restricted, very simple, and every artist had to use this. Only this. It has to be according to the standard. If it's not to the standard, we can't broadcast it. So they learned how to do teletext, and some really liked it. And we know some of them have already participated last year, so they did new work, or they changed, or advanced. It's really interesting. And for them, it's special too, I think.
Do you think that this is a medium on the move? I mean, are more and more artists getting interested in this? It's a bit low tech, if you don't mind me saying that.
I mean, it's both. Teletext, on one hand, is really, we say, retro designs. Look, it's coming, it's 30 years old, you know? And in times where you have high definition, 3D, everything gets more sharper, more colors, then you have this old-fashioned approach. It goes back maybe to the past. We said some of them have been kids in the 80s. Maybe they have used very ancient computer games, so maybe it's a little bit nostalgia. But on the other hand, the content, what they are going to say is new. You know, we have references to the internet. There's this angry man meme, which is a face in the internet. Or we have Lindsay Lohan. She's very famous in the internet because she has been arrested several times. And now we have her picture in teletext, and this makes a very special effect. It's hard for me to explain because I'm not an artist. I'm a news editor, actually, but I find this interesting. And I wouldn't say teletext art is a new brand, but the artist, they work on different media. Some of them work in electronic arts, some of them make music. And they said, okay, we can do something for teletext. It's really fun, it's nice, it's interesting.
That was Frauke Langus talking to Kim Bradley about teletext art. The festival runs until the 15th of September and really does have to be seen and not heard. So go to teletextart.com or just tune in to ARDORF or Switztext, preferably at night, to see more. Still to come in part two, more music and some contemplation from Emily Barker. We'll hear an orchestra powered by the wind in Helsinki. And ever wonder what the Rolling Stones sound like underwater? Plenty of treats still to come on this here Culture Show on Monocle 24. So back to this week's session and to Emily Barker, who came to play some tracks from her new record, Dear River, which she describes as a letter home to her motherland. After the session, she sat down with fellow Australian Andrew Miller to talk about how the distance from her birthplace has fed into her work. But first up, here she is with Ghost Narrative.
I really wanted to challenge myself. Having been instilled with such a strong sense of place and family and home, I really wanted to break away from that and experience other cultures and challenge myself and feel uncomfortable where I was. And so all those things have contributed to inspiring various songs.
As you mentioned while introducing one of the songs you just played for us, it's hard or indeed impossible for any Australian of European descent to I guess, rigorously consider the idea of their home without acknowledging the fact that that home was taken off other people.
Yeah.
How easy or difficult, I guess, or I guess what I'm really asking is how nervous were you about the idea of trying to write something about that? Because it is a, it's an area in which the most well-intentioned of white commentators and white artists can stumble very, very easily.
Absolutely. No, I was really conscious of, I didn't want to speak on behalf of Indigenous Australians in any way. I was conscious of speaking from a European Australian's point of view. And that's where I realised that I still have a voice and I should be able to express that rather than just feeling guilt and feeling like I just need to, we all need to listen. So what I'm trying to promote through my songs that touch on the subject of Indigenous politics is encouraging other non-Indigenous Australians to listen and learn from our Indigenous culture. So my songs are more pointed towards them rather than speaking on behalf of Indigenous Australians.
What do your British and European audiences make of those songs?
They're really interested in it, actually, because I don't think it's necessarily a well-known fact that the Indigenous people in Australia are still so oppressed and you know, often living in third world conditions within Australia, which has got this almost squeaky clean international reputation in a lot of ways. So there's so much that goes on there that people are surprised about when they hear it.
This new record's a departure for you, I guess, not just in terms of its sound and its lyrical outlook, but in the way it appears. You've actually signed to a record label.
Yes, Lynn Records.
Which is an unusual record label to have signed to.
It is. They're doing their first sort of non-classical and jazz releases since the 1980s when they did the Blue Nile, quite a cult Scottish band. So it's been a really exciting partnership because my previous three albums were all released on my own record label, and Lynn are just starting to branch out into other sort of genres. So we're both really excited by the partnership.
Is it making a significant difference to how you're actually able to, you know, operate as a musician? If you, I mean, are you finding, I guess, any sort of sense of compromise? You've got, for better and, you know, there's good things and bad things about having to do everything yourself.
Mm.
The good thing is, of course, you get to do everything the way you like it.
Yes. So far, we have done everything the way, certainly creatively, artistically, everything the way that we would have liked to have done things. If anything, well, definitely, we've been really complimented by Lynn's attitude towards the sound quality. So I presented the songs, they loved the songs, and then they teamed us up with a producer called Callum Malcolm. And so their aim was just to get the best sound recording of the songs. So it was really exciting, and I think we've really achieved that. It's certainly, for me, our greatest sounding record.
To return to Dear River, the new album, which is, of course, very much rooted in where you came from, do you think that in doing with this album you've sort of said or thought everything you want to say about where you came from? Did it feel like a kind of wrapping up and putting thing in a box and sending it away, as these things can?
Well, yes and no. What I found was it was really interesting to put some sort of boundary on my songwriting. I really enjoyed that because there's so much to cover within that boundary. And usually when you're writing songs, you can write about whatever you like. So that was great. But I also realised as I got more and more involved with covering like a lot of the subtexts of home, such as exile and immigration and Indigenous politics, and I was quite studious about it. And I could have kept on going and going and going. I feel like I could write about home for the rest of my life in some ways. But having said that, I also feel that I answered the question on a basic level, which is that I do consider my home by the Blackwood River, where my parents still live now, and my first home, I do consider that as my overall truest sense of home. And the final song on the record, called The Blackwood, sort of sees me returning there one day, I don't know when, but I definitely would like my ashes scattered in the river.
That was Emily Barker talking to Andrew Muller. Emily's new album, Dear River, is out now on Lynn Records, and she'll be on tour across the UK from October. If you're over here and want to catch her live, emily-barker.com has all the details. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Well, we heard earlier about what's going on in Edinburgh, but Finland's largest art festival, the Helsinki Festival, is also currently in full swing. It boasts a diverse programme ranging from pop music and contemporary dance to visual arts and film. And one of the highlights of the festival was the recent Night of the Arts, which is celebrating its 25th year. Over 200 free events took place across Helsinki, including the Harmonic Fields, an installation consisting of handmade instruments which are played not by people, but by the wind. Intrigued? Yes, well, so are we. So we sent reporter Mark Bosworth to meet its creator, French composer Pierre Sauvageau, who explained what inspired him to make it.
It's when I saw these incredible traditional scarecrows built in Bali. Farmers had, long time ago, this scarecrow in wood, very simple xylophone, making some tiki-tung, 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 very, very simple, very beautiful objects. But in fact, today, they don't use it more, and they just have a plastic bag. And they built very small one scarecrows, not very beautiful, and they sell it to the tourist. So it was also funny for me to say, okay, these very beautiful instruments, they are now just something for tourists. So it's quite a pity.
And you have some of these Balinese scarecrows here amongst the 500 or so instruments as part of the Harmonic Fields installation. You've also got harmonic cellos, vibrating drums, musical boxes, bamboo poles which are swaying in the wind. It's a wonderful sight out on the Helsinki waterfront, seeing these handmade instruments swaying and moving in the wind with the backdrop of the beautiful archipelago beyond us.
Yes, they are discussing together also, because they are very happy to be here. And of course, each time that depends on the wind, but you mix all those different sounds together. And that depends also if you are staying in one place or running or just walking. Sometimes our artists propose a blind visit. It's a very, very, very strong, amazing moment, because incredible, you are in place.
You are a composer by trade, so how does composing an outdoor wind installation like this differ from a more traditional performance?
In fact, it's not so different, because like in an orchestra, we have string instruments, wind instruments, and the percussion and the rhythm of the windmill. So they are very, very simple sounds, but you can manage together to have a place very soft and a place harder, as when you write a symphony.
You've taken Harmonic Fields to different parts of Europe, France, the Netherlands, Denmark, Austria. Does the sound differ according to the whim of the wind?
Maybe the most changing element is the audience, because people don't have the same reactions. Sometimes they are very quiet and they really go in relaxation. Of course, instruments are the same and mix are not so different, but also the wind is not the same. Sometimes we are a place where the wind is always changing. So for me, it's very interesting, because you have a tiki 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 in silence and a boom 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 another place. So instruments are discussing together, answering together. It's not the same when you have a very constant wind. So instruments have always the same sound. So of course it's very different, and each time I'm quite very pleased to hear it again.
And of course all of this does depend on having wind. Are you frantically checking the weather charts every hour before the performance? I mean, what happens if there isn't any wind?
Yes, I'm looking forecast every time, and it's quite a pity for me. But in fact, it's not so bad. When we have very few wind, it's quite oftenly better. Audience is silenter, softer, and listening quite better. So it's not a big problem when we have few wind.
So it's encouraging people to listen better?
Yes, in fact, yes. The main problem with few wind audience want to help instrument to make music. So that's quite terrible. They have stick and they try to play the percussion and we have to say, no, please, that musical instrument, please don't go on stage and don't take the Stradivarius of the first violinist to play yourself, please. And it's okay like that.
That was French composer Pierre Sauvageau talking to Mark Bosworth. The harmonic fields have just come to a close, but they're part of a wider project called Sounding City, which runs in Helsinki until Sunday. Ever wanted to play the clamberine? More underwater band-related puns coming up next.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino. And our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where to end the show today, we're off to the Florida Keys. Every summer for 28 years, a partnership between the area's Chamber of Commerce and US One Radio has drawn a fleet of dive boats and small pleasure craft out of Lou Key, a coral reef that's a few miles offshore and about 100 miles south of Miami. Festival goers gather to celebrate coral reef and ocean conservation by playing and listening to music underwater. So put on your swimsuit, grab your mask and snorkel, and stay tuned as Nancy Ancrum guides us to this unusual music venue.
The Underwater Music Festival is celebrated offshore from the Florida Keys. It's about a four-hour drive to get to the little island where we will catch the boat out to the coral reef. US One Radio is the local station for the Florida Keys, and they're a co-sponsor of the event. They put together a special playlist just for today, featuring water-themed music. As the son of a sailor, it takes about an hour to motor out on the dive boat to the coral reef. US One Radio keeps us company, amplified over the PA system.
We're going to get back to the music. Hope you enjoyed it. And we are out here celebrating, by the way, 50 years of the Rolling Stones. And we got a couple of our characters dressed up as the Rolling Stones. And anyway, back to the music here at the Underwater Music Festival on US One Radio.
Thank you, Bill.
That was Bill Becker, trained as a marine biologist and co-founder of the festival. He's also news director at US One Radio. Okay, the Rolling Stones are not here, but their costumed impersonators are ready to dive into the water and to play their instruments down on a sandy patch among the corals, about 15 feet underwater.
I am Mick Jawfish. I'm gonna sing. That's what Mick does, he sings.
Keith Pitchard. I'm having fun already.
Yes, that was Keith's clamberine.
I am Debbie Novak. I am one of the board of directors for the Lower Keys Chamber of Commerce. And today at the festival, I am Charlie Wahoo.
The singing is mostly bubbles, but music and public service announcements are broadcast through special underwater speakers once the boat is anchored. Bill Becker explains.
A friend and I like diving and we like music. We said, how can we put these two things together? We contact Lubel Laboratories and they loaned us some underwater speakers and we picked up the radio signal out on the reef and broadcast it underwater. And everybody liked it so much, they said, let's make this an annual thing.
Now, here we are, ready to pile into the water, properly anchored so we don't damage the reef. Sarah Mae Bruner is this year's mermaid. She's suited up in bikini top and pink tail and looks down into the water to her musical companions.
Think of lip syncing only underwater. Everyone's playing an instrument, we're dancing, and we're just having a good time. The reef is absolutely wonderful. The fish count is amazing. There's a ton of fish down there. We're in a different area. We're on the backside of the reef. There's a ton of schools. There's a sergeant major. There'll be large schools of sergeant majors. They look like little bumblebee fish. Blue tangs, that's what Dory is on Finding Nemo. Yellowtail snappers, you'll see some barracuda. They just smile at you. Parrotfish, all different colors of the rainbow. Midnight parrotfish, blue parrotfish.
Clearly, she's hooked.
Anyway, back to the music here at the Underwater Music Festival.
Thank you, Bill.
The music underwater kind of sounds like a transistor radio. But if you're underwater, you say, that's pretty cool. Normally, it's a very silent world. No matter where you are on the reef, you can hear the music. You can understand the words. The fish seem to sway with the music.
Bill Causey has been a reef sanctuary administrator for decades. He's totally committed to the conservation message. But as for the music...
I always look forward to hearing the Jaws theme. It makes you look over your shoulder.
Time to get back on dry land. For Monocle in Miami, this is Nancy Yankrum.
Fishy. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be soaking up a glorious session from Joss Stone and taking a creative journey through London's Olympic story with music writer Jude Rogers. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was the long-suffering Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher was back again this week. And boy, can you hear it? Time for one final song this week from her new album, Dear River, and her splendiferous Midori House session. This is Emily Barker with Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in.
We stand waiting for the call, and I've got nothing to explain. They've stopped nesting in the rooftops. They've stopped nesting above the wall. We'll start again with coats and fears, blood in the pond. We are still waiting here, and this floor means nothing to me now. We gotta run, dear, dear heart of mine. We gotta go. There's a break in the rain, so grab your guitars. It'll happen. Till the morning, they won't wake until the dawn. He's been and gone, another bloody waste. Crows at the door, long before we could make it. They've stopped nesting in the rooftops. They've stopped nesting above the wall. There's no room for us here, and all this emptiness, we gotta run. Gotta run.